From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Tsunami disaster was something my country has not seen for the last 2,500 years of our history. But we are very happy that the support that we got from the international community to rebuild from the American people. We are determined to build better and build equity.
Today, the tsunami that devastated South Asia. On this first anniversary, we'll speak with the Sri Lankan ambassador to the United Nations, an anti-poverty activist in Sri Lanka and a physician treating Tamil refugees. And we'll look at post-tsunami Indonesia with former State Department official Ed McWilliams.
There's growing concern that one of the principal dividends of the tsunami relief effort, that is the peace deal in Aceh, may come undone as the Indonesian military plans to deploy another 15,000 troops into Aceh, essentially breaking the peace deal that had been arrived at this past year.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting defense lawyers for several Muslim men detained for alleged ties to al-Qaeda plan to bring legal challenges to determine whether the government used illegal wiretaps against them. 2 weeks ago, the Times revealed the Bush administration has authorized eavesdropping on Americans and foreign nationals within the United States without court orders. The challenges would affect some of the biggest terrorism cases in the country. Several lawyers say they intend to press the government on whether prosecutors misled the courts about the origins of their investigations and whether the government may have withheld wiretaps that could prove their clients' innocence. Meanwhile, Justice Department prosecutors told the New York Times they're concerned the wiretaps could create problems for past and future terrorism cases. One prosecutor said, quote, "If I'm a defense attorney, the first thing I'm going to say in court is this was an illegal wiretap." Meanwhile, the Muslim Public Affairs Council has called on Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and FBI Director Robert Mueller to meet with American Muslim leaders in response to reports the federal government has been secretly monitoring radiation levels at Muslim sites and cities across the country. In Aceh, rebel leaders announced the disarmament of their military wing Tuesday, completing the latest stage of a peace agreement reached with the Indonesian government. This is Irwandi Yusuf of the Free Aceh Movement, known as GAM.
On behalf of GAM combatants, I have the honor to announce that the Aceh National Armed Force, TNA, or GAM fighters, are now demobilized and decommissioned. We have now handed over all our GAMs in compliance to the agreement of the Memorandum of Understanding signed between the Government of Indonesia and the Free Aceh Movement in Helsinki on August 15, 2005.
Some Indonesian forces are expected to withdraw on Thursday. Under the peace agreement, close to 25,000 Indonesian soldiers and police will remain in the province located on the northern tip of the Sumatra Island. Over 170,000 people were killed or went missing in Aceh in the tsunami of 1 year ago. We'll have more on Aceh and the politics of Indonesia later in the program. In Iraq, more than 10,000 people marched through Baghdad Tuesday to protest alleged fraud in the country's recent national elections. The marchers called for a national unity government to overcome Iraq's sectarian divisions with chants of, quote, "no Sunnis, no Shiites, yes for national unity." Early results indicate the religious Shiite coalition, the United Iraqi Alliance, has won a vast majority of the National Assembly. But leaders from both Sunni and smaller secular Shiite parties say the vote was marred with fraud. Meanwhile, authorities in the Iraqi city of Karbala have uncovered a mass grave containing the bodies of at least 30 people. The dead are thought to be victims of Saddam Hussein's suppression of a Shiite uprising following the 1991 Gulf invasion. Some 300 possible mass graves have been reported since U.S. forces overthrew Saddam Hussein's government in April 2003, most of them in the southern Shiite areas and in Kurdish areas of the north. In other news from Iraq, the Los Angeles Times is reporting gas prices in the country have increased fivefold since national elections 2 weeks ago. The increase is attributed to a debt forgiveness deal signed with the International Monetary Fund that requires the interim Iraqi government to cut fuel subsidies. Gas is selling for a reported 65 cents a gallon, up from 5 cents over the summer. Robert Mabro, former chair of the Oxford Institute of Energy Studies, said, quote, the subsidies may be big, but the situation in Iraq is such a mess. If there's a price increase, if they remove some of the subsidies, it'll cause a lot of hardship. Elsewhere in the Middle East, Israel's launched its deepest attack into Lebanese territory in over a year. Late Tuesday, Israeli warplanes struck a training base for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine in southern Lebanon. The attack followed a rocket attack that damaged some property in the Israeli border town of Kiryat Shmona. The border clashes have continued since Israel ended 22 years of occupation of southern Lebanon in the year 2000. In New York, the Transport Workers Union has announced a tentative agreement with state officials on a new contract. A bitter labor dispute shut down the city's buses and subways over 3 days last week. Under the tentative deal, workers would receive close to an 11% pay rise over 3 years. State officials have dropped demands that would have raised both the retirement age and the pension contributions of new workers. Workers would now contribute a portion of their salaries to health care, which had previously been provided without charge. The union's 33,000 members will now vote on whether to approve the agreement. In Colombia, 28 soldiers were killed Tuesday in what authorities called the deadliest rebel assault this year. The attack, carried out by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, occurred in Vista Hermosa, south of Bogota. The soldiers had been carrying out a coca eradication operation. The Colombian government has waged a U.S.-backed military offensive against the FARC in the region where the attack occurred. Meanwhile, the Organization of American States said Tuesday that right-wing paramilitary groups are responsible for a massacre that left at least 8 people dead in the northern Curumani region earlier this month. The OAS says the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or AUC, took hostages and killed at least 8 people after clashes with leftist guerrillas. The AUC had previously agreed to a ceasefire with the government. Critics say the ceasefire has done little to prevent the AUC from carrying out drug smuggling and other criminal activities. In the Philippines, prosecutors have charged 4 U.S. Marines with the rape of a 22-year-old Filipina woman. The alleged incident took place near a former U.S. Navy base last month. This is Filipino prosecutor Raymond Viray.
In view of the foregoing, let an information for rape be filed against respondents Lieutenant Corporal Daniel Smith, Staff Sergeant Chad Carpenter, Lieutenant Corporal Dominic Duplantis, and Lieutenant Corporal Kit Silkwood and Timoteo Soriano.
Prosecutor Raymond Viray announcing the charges in Olongapo City on Tuesday. The U.S. Embassy has not responded to a request to hand the accused soldiers over to local authorities. Here in the United States, the Washington Post is reporting nearly 50 people have been charged for taking part in a scheme to defraud a Red Cross program of hundreds of thousands of dollars intended for victims of Hurricane Katrina. 17 of the accused worked at a Red Cross claim center in California. The rest were relatives and friends of the workers. The claim center was responsible for taking calls from Katrina victims and authorizing cash payments to them. In other news, the former chief accountant for the scandal-plagued energy corporation Enron has reached a plea deal that will see him testify against 2 of the company's top former executives. Richard Causey will appear in a Houston court today to plead guilty to at least one of the dozens of criminal charges against him. In return for leniency, Causey will testify against Enron founder Ken Lay and former CEO Jeffrey Skilling. Causey is the 16th former Enron executive to reach a plea bargain. He was expected to stand trial alongside Lay and Skilling next month. Enron's collapse in 2001 ended the jobs of more than 5,000 workers and decimated the retirement savings of millions of investors. And in Austria, anger over the execution of Stanley Tookie Williams has led to the removal of California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's name from the stadium in his hometown of Graz. Williams, the former gang leader turned peace advocate and children's author, was put to death December 13th after Schwarzenegger refused his bid for clemency. The execution caused outrage in the United States and around the world. The decision was bitterly condemned in Graz, whose slogan is "The City of Human Rights." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Memorials are being held across the world this week to mark the devastating tsunami that hit South Asia 1 year ago. It was one of the world's worst ever natural disasters. On the morning of December 26, scientists recorded one of the world's most powerful earthquakes ever off the coast of the Indonesian island of Sumatra. Scientists soon realized the earthquake could form a deadly tsunami. But unlike the Pacific Ocean, the Indian Ocean region had no tsunami warning system. The results were catastrophic. Within hours, some 218,000 people had died across Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and India. Nearly 2 million were left homeless, and the effects will be felt for years. A new survey from Oxfam found 80% of the 1.8 million people left homeless by the disaster were still without satisfactory permanent housing. On the Indonesian island of Sumatra, all residents are still living in tents or shelters. Overall, Oxfam estimates some 300,000 new houses still need to be built in India, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka. Later in the program, we'll examine the tsunami's effect on Indonesia. But we begin in Sri Lanka, where more than 31,000 people died in and after the tsunami. The United Nations has reported Sri Lanka alone needs 100,000 homes. Only about 6,000 have been built so far. We're joined in the studio by the ambassador from Sri Lanka to the United Nations. We are joined on the telephone from California and Sri Lanka. On the phone, Sarath Fernando is with us. He's the co-director of the Movement for National Land and Agricultural Reform in Sri Lanka. Also joining us from California is Dr. Karunyan Arul, physician who works with Tamil refugees and other war victims. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! And we begin with the ambassador. Welcome. Can you talk about Sri Lanka today, a year after the tsunami?
First, let me take this opportunity to thank the American public and the international community on this solemn occasion for sharing our grief and for coming readily to our help. We were touched by it, and we felt humanity is alive. As you know, the destruction caused by tsunami in Sri Lanka is enormous, and 2/3 of our coastline was affected. 1 million people were displaced. 98,000 dwellings were destroyed. Nearly 40,000 people went missing or killed. In a situation like that, the rebuilding effort, we have estimated, will take between 3 to 5 years. At this point, although everyone is in temporary shelters and permanent shelters are being built, and we are aware of that the slow progress, but that we want to build better and build with equity. And because the tsunami touches all areas of the country. In a situation like that, we are constrained by various factors. But we have certain guiding principles. We want transparency, we want equity, all that is there. We are also the livelihood of people. 150,000 people have lost their livelihood. So we have to rebuild their livelihoods. We have to build protection. But we have set up a blueprint for that, and we have international community support. In fact, I have to thank again President Clinton, UN Special Tsunami Envoy, for being a bedrock, giving us bedrock support for the whole recovery process. We think we estimate $2.1 billion are required for reconstruction in Sri Lanka. We have commitment for that. But, of course, we need to make commitments to disbursements. At this point, we have disbursed only $500 million. Its process is going forward.
We're also joined on the ground in Sri Lanka by Sarath Fernando of the Movement for National Land and Agricultural Reform. From your perspective there, can you describe the progress, the devastation first, and then where you are today?
The degree of devastation is fairly accurate as described by the ambassador. 40,000 lives were lost. According to the government's own figures, the number of houses destroyed was 80,000. About 500,000 people have been displaced. There is a very important factor in the north and east. People who were affected by the war, 20 years of war, and people who have been living in temporary shelter and camps for as long as 20 years have been also hit by the tsunami. So they face two disasters at the same time. Now, regarding the recovery process, what Oxfam says is very correct. The number of houses, permanent houses, built is very small. It's about 4,000 odd. And about 80% or more of the people have lived now in temporary or what they call transitory houses for one full year. And living in this kind of situation is not very easy. And in Sri Lanka, we have had several very heavy monsoons, and there is a dry period when things become very hot, and these people have been living in this kind of situation for one full year. Now, if I may say something about the reasons for this kind of situation, I would put the blame very much on the government policies and plans. As soon as tsunami occurred, within about less than 10 days, a body was appointed, three task forces were appointed, and one was called the Task Force for Rebuild in the Nation, TAFRAN. All people who were appointed to that task force were the topmost business representatives, private business representatives in the country. There were government officials who were also big private business operators. And many of them were owners of the biggest tourist hotel companies in Sri Lanka. As a result, they prepared plans very quickly. By 15th of January, the first plan was ready. And this, according to this plan, the biggest priority given is not to help the process of recovery of the affected people. I would give concrete figures about this coming from the first plan. The total allocation, out of a total allocation of $1.5 billion, the total allocation for housing and townships was $400 million. Out of the $400 million, the amount allocated for temporary shelter was $20 million only, and the amount allocated for permanent housing for destroyed, completely destroyed fisher houses, 80,000, was $80 million. This comes to about $1,000 per house. Subsequently, the government has declared another figure of 250,000, which is about $2,500 per house. But the government requested and got a lot of finances. I think the largest contribution of people from all over the world, governments and non-governmental agencies and so on, civilians, this was the biggest contribution that came for any kind of disaster of this type. Now, with all that, the amount that was allocated for housing, temporary housing and permanent housing for destroyed fisher people's houses, the amount that the government spent was almost nothing. I'm saying this because all the temporary shelter was built by non-governmental organizations. Many international non-governmental organizations came in. And regarding permanent housing, what the government is doing is they have started or they have signed memoranda of understanding with INGOs, international non-governmental organizations, and local NGOs to build houses at their expense. Therefore, the government has not spent the amount that they allocated for this kind of thing by the government.
Sarath Fernando, we are going to go to break. When we come back, we'll get response from the ambassador. We'll also talk with Dr. Arul, who works with Tamil refugees in Sri Lanka, and talk about the politics of the distribution of aid in this year after the tsunami. And then we'll look at Indonesia, ground zero, Aceh, for the tsunami. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on 400 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, low-power FM community and college stations, as well as on public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about this first anniversary of the tsunami, particularly looking at Sri Lanka and Indonesia. Right now, joined by the permanent representative of Sri Lanka to the UN, Ambassador Prasad Kariawasam. We're also joined by Sarath Fernando in Sri Lanka, just outside Colombo, of the Movement for National Land and Agricultural Reform. And on the line with us from California is Dr. Karunyan Arul, a Tamil physician who works with Tamil refugees. Ambassador, your response to the critique that Sarath Fernando talked about, who gets help and who doesn't in Sri Lanka?
Well, first of all, I'm happy that you had one individual from Sri Lanka who is representing a non-governmental organization giving his view. The country, ours is a vibrant democracy and everyone has a right to his opinion. But I must emphasize that government has to work with many players, not only one individual or one organization. In fact, government set up a blueprint for reconstruction and rehabilitation in consultation with 20 government institutions, 20 bilateral and multilateral organizations, 18 national and NGOs contributing relevant details. So we have to coordinate large number of donors, contributors, and then the wishers. And we need to, when you coordinate and set up a blueprint and implement that, there could be criticism from some quarters that it is not happening in the way that they individually wanted. And we have to build equity, and we have to build in such a manner that it is sustainable, and we need to take into account local politics of it. So we understand there could be certain drawbacks in the perception of some people, that the way that the government is proceeding. But the fact remains, things are happening on the ground. There had been no outbreak of diseases. Everyone is now having temporary shelter. Permanent housing are being built. Plans are there for infrastructure rehabilitation. Donor coordination is transparent. Everything is on a website where we have a very transparent mechanism. We work very closely with the UN United Nations system, in particular with President Clinton's office, that is the Office for Tsunami Recovery. I think government is transparent, government is committed. It is, but it could be sometimes there could be various weaves that are not in line with the others. But
Sarath Fernando, your response.
Now, about equity, I would like to give further details. In the plan, I don't believe that they consulted all the people, but in the list he mentioned, there are no representatives of the affected people. That was one big mistake, and the total error that has led to the present situation, because in our view, this is not my personal view, I talk on behalf of more than 200 organizations who are campaigning on this issue. They are now appointed a People's Planning Commission comprising of very eminent people, university professors and others. Now, about equity, in the first plan, they allocated for housing this $100 million, but they have set apart $300 million for what they call township building. Now, in the report, in that proposal, they say there would be 12 large townships, 20 medium-sized townships, and 30 small townships, all with modernized facilities. Now, the whole approach, as described by Mr. Mano Tittavella, who was heading the TAFRAN earlier, he said that tsunami has given an opportunity for Sri Lanka to become a modernized society that can meet the dreams of the 21st century. Now, a limited, very small group of elite, rich elite, had some dreams about a modernized society for the 21st century. But these are very limited group of people who are not at all affected by tsunami. The large numbers of people who are affected by tsunami, who are living in the present miserable conditions were not consulted. If they were consulted, they would have said, before you build all these modernized townships for which only the rich people can use these are not for tsunami-affected people, because in the plan, they have said that they are putting up houses separately, 80,000 houses at a cost of $1,000 each. That is what the plan says. Therefore, you can understand the type of equity. Later on, in May, when the donors came to Sri Lanka and had further discussions, the total budget increase from $1.5 billion, if I am correct, the figure given by the ambassador was different. It was the next budget was $3.2 billion. In the plan, in that plan, they have said they will build 15 tourism development zones right around the beaches. So 62 modernized townships and 15 large tourism development zones, one of which is to be in Arugambe. That alone, the estimated cost is $80 million. You know, the amount allocated or to be allocated for one tourist resort is equivalent to the amount allocated for 80,000 fisher people's houses. Now, in the beaches, in this territory that was affected, if you are going to build 62 modernized townships and 15 such tourism development zones, there would be no space for fisher people to live anywhere. That is why, if you look at the decision to declare the buffer zone, the decision was taken very quickly, within about a week or so after tsunami. They said no family would be allowed to go between 100 meters and 200 meters in the east coast and live on the beaches. But simultaneously, they said tourist hotels would be permitted to repair and start business. Sir. And within week, they started business. Now they have introduced 15 new tourism development zones, which will completely push out the fisher people. In Arugambe, the fisher people would be pushed out by 18 kilometers, not 17 kilometers.
Sarath Fernando, I wanted to bring in our other guest as well, Dr. Karanyan Arol, to talk about the situation as well from the political perspective of what has been happening in Sri Lanka. The government right now in a very difficult period. The Sri Lankan government and Tamil Tiger rebels must resume peace talks immediately to prevent a return to civil war, according to peace monitors. The Norwegian peace envoy said there's no time to lose. So at the same time, the tsunami has so seriously impacted Sri Lanka. There is a very serious political divide in the country between the Tamils and the government. Dr. Arul, can you talk about tsunami politics and the politics of what is happening in your country, particularly in the north?
Yeah, thank you, Amy. And, you know, I too, like the ambassador, want to thank the generosity of the U.S. people for giving us all this money. Unfortunately, these funds perhaps may have exacerbated the existing divisions that are in the island and may have contributed to this sad situation where there is essentially a war breaking out, with all these signs of war breaking out, such as sweep arrests and midnight searches and checkpoints. And what happened is tsunami hit mainly the Tamil areas. 70% of the areas hit were the Tamil areas, the eastern province. And substantial portions of these areas are controlled by the rebel Tamils. And the government stopped foreign dignitaries, including President Clinton, including Kofi Annan, from visiting to just see the devastation. In other words, the politics of the country, the division between the government and the Tamils, which had been there for decades, prevented the government of even allowing, seeing what the damage was. And this same attitude of the government of marginalizing the Tamils, which has been in place for decades, has been continued into the tsunami politics. And what has happened is the monies that came in, many of the NGOs and foreign governments realized that the Sri Lankan singleized government state was incapable of delivering what is needed to the Tamils in the northeast, who were the most affected by the tsunami. And what they did was, with the help of the Norwegians, they worked out a scheme, an administrative scheme, to share administrative responsibility in distributing this money, and that was called the PTOMS, Post-Tsunami Operational Management Structure. Unfortunately, the inherent racism that is so prevalent in the south of this country appealed against it, and they used various legal and other methods, and the PTOMS agreement, which was hailed by all countries, essentially was scuttled. Had the PTOMS been there, it would have been a confidence builder between the rebels and the Sri Lankan army to move forward in the peace process that had stalled with the new government coming in. I'm talking the previous government, the Mr. Rajapaksa's government. And thus, tsunami money, the tsunami, sadly, has only exacerbated the divisions and the iniquity. All the discussion that Mr. Fernando had is essentially about the South, which is only 30% of the affected land. 70% of the affected land remains untouched, and there is a war there, a war that is impeding tsunami reconstruction, and the government in center, which does not want to give up reconstructive powers to the people. It is the people are being denied that money, and so the confidence of the Tamils and the rebels in the government
from
to deal with them is breaking down, and there's war.
Ambassador, your response.
Thank you. Sadly, good doctor seems to be out of touch with reality. He lives in California. Perhaps he does not know what's happening. Let me clarify a few things. First of all, 2/3 of our coast was affected, and most people who died in the tsunami was those who belong to what is called the Muslim community, who has no track with the Tamil rebels or LTT. And they were in the eastern province. That is the place where that has been destroyed most. And reconstruction, rehabilitation is going on very well in that area, and that I can vouch for that. Second, the allegation that the VVIPs like President Clinton and Kofi Annan did not visit the North and the East is not true. I myself was in Sri Lanka. I accompanied Mr. Kofi Annan to Trincomalee, and where we visited the Tamil refugee camps. We met TRO. We met so that is again not true. President Clinton even this time went to Kalmune. That's the eastern province coastal village. So these are all politics of it. What is unfortunate is that people who live in this country are living in the past. They're living in a kind of a dream world of their own, and that is preventing us from reconciliation. And we expected, in fact, when the tsunami did not distinguish between communities. It struck everybody equally. And at that time, there was great warmth between the people. I know stories of soldiers risking their life to save Tamil civilians, which happened in the north and the east. Those are facts. I had my own friend doctors who were living in Colombo who drove to the north and to the east rather than to the south. They were Sinhalese doctors because they said these people need help. That's the spirit. But we expected after the tsunami, the Tamil rebels, the LTT, to change their ways, change their political agenda of total separation. But as has been confirmed by the international community, including the facilitators of peace process, appeal to LTT, change your ways, learn the art of compromise in politics, learn the art of not the art of violence to achieve your own ends. What they are doing today is still the same, more of the same. So that is a tragedy. But the government and the international community is committed to reach out to each and every corner in the country, and it is being done. Despite all this rhetoric, on the ground, rehabilitation is taking place in the north and the east, and that's a fact. And no one is in despair. No one is having any problem now. So that is the reality on the ground.
Dr. Arul, your response.
Ambassador, you know, perhaps we are both living in different realities, and you have a reality. That's not the point. Let me make my point. Isn't it a fact that the rebel held area, Mullathivu, which was very badly hit, was never visited by a foreign dignitary, I'm specifically talking of Kofi Annan and President Clinton. They visited Eastern Province, which is under government control. Okay, isn't it a fact that the government agreed to share administrative responsibilities with the LTT, and then it is the Sinhala South and their politics that broke it, and that when they reneged on the agreement? These are facts.
Can you explain for 1 minute, just for people who are not familiar with the politics of Sri Lanka, the presidential election took place when? This is since the tsunami, about a month ago?
Yeah.
Can you talk about the policy change, the agreement before the presidential election and the agreement afterwards, from each of your perspective, Dr. Arul?
Well, in the presidential election, there was a very clear choice on the single electorate. The single electorate had two candidates, one who wanted to grant some degree of federalism to the Tamils, who wanted to share power with the Tamils, which has been the basic problem in the political conflict that is going on, in sharing power with the Tamils. Another candidate who wanted what is called a unitary government, where all power resides in Colombo, and another government which would not accept the basic identity needs of the Tamils, which are being threatened by the Sinhala government policies over many decades, including the right of self-determination, right of management of their affairs, etc. There was a very clear choice. And the Sinhala electorate voted for the person who said, we will not share power with the Tamils. And Tamils did not participate as much as they did in the other elections, and so the choice was made by the Sinhala people, and it's very clear. And so the current government has taken steps back in the peace process and the assumptions of how the peace should be done, which essentially was by sharing power with the Tamils. And so we are in a quandary, and war is starting. And it is so paramount that there has to be peace. There has to be peace. There's no point putting blame game and pointing who's there and what they did in the past. And I think in order for them to peace to come back, the first thing to do is the government must meet with the Tamils, not put conditions of where they want to meet, not try to marginalize them, not try to isolate the Tamil communities from the international community, not demonize them, but sit and talk with them and, first of all, implement the ceasefire agreement, which is already in place, and then go towards the political solution, which I think the current president, who is a pragmatic man by many, many things, hopefully will work towards. So that's what I would like to say. There's a clear choice. The electorate had a clear choice. They went in one direction. So the Sinhala South has to decide how much of power they want to share with the Tamils.
Sarath Fernando, you're in the South. Your response?
I would like to agree very much with what doctor said about the situation in the North. Now, what I would like to add to what he said is that entire Sinhala constituency in the South is not the racist group that is crying out against any kind of settlement. There are many organizations here. Now, about discrimination of the people against the people in the North is very true. Now, concrete figures, if I give, the amount allocated for a tsunami-affected family and the individual for their daily food and expenses and so on is much higher than the amount allocated for such requirements for war-affected people who have been living in those temporary camps for 20 years. And they should get less. Therefore, there are such incidents. Now, it's not the people who are doing this. That's my point. Now, for instance, I work with a network of organizations, about 200 organizations, fisheries sector organizations working in the North, East, and also in the South. They're working very well together with the fisheries organizations in the North, and we have taken positions about the settlement of this issue. We are totally in support of a complete devolution of power. The people in the North, the Muslims in that area, and the people in the North, the Tamil people in the North, have the complete right to decide on their own about what kind of recovery, what kind of development, what kind of economy they want. They should have the control over the resources in that area, whether it's the sea or the land. So therefore, it's very necessary that that's the only way a settlement could be reached. A central government wanting to centralize power, whether they are representing the extreme Sinhala in the South or otherwise, the total interest is to have control over all resources and all people, and to do something that would destroy not only the people in the north, but also the people in the south.
Well, Ambassador, we have just one last 30 seconds. December, the bloodiest month since the Sri Lankan truce came into effect in 2002. You represent the new government.
Well, government, successive government is committed to democracy. We had a democratic elections. Unfortunately, LTT, that is Tamil Tigers, led some Tamils boycott elections. Tamils are in the government. There are Tamil ministers in the government. Government is committed to talk to Tamils. Government is committed for substantial devolution of power. Government is committed to let Tamils run their own affairs in the north and east. It is up to the LTT to respond to that, change their ways, and come to the negotiating table and talk. They should not depend on violence. It's unfortunate some people still talk LTT language, while LTT is a banned terrorist organization in this country. And because they are bent on violence, we want to talk to LTT. We want to talk to Tamil people are in the government. We are committed for all what I agree with Mr. Fernando, that actually what Mr. Fernando is what said is what government has in mind. We want to talk. We don't want war. But LTT does not seem to change their ways. That is our problem.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you all for being with us. Prasad Kariawasam is the ambassador of Sri Lanka to the United Nations, representing the new government of Sri Lanka. Sarath Fernando, Movement for National Land and Agricultural Reform, known as MONLAR, in Sri Lanka. And Dr. Karunya Narul, Tamil physician, working in Los Angeles with Tamil refugees. When we come back, we'll look at another country, ground zero for the tsunami 1 year later. We'll look at Indonesia and particularly Aceh. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to look at Indonesia, the hardest hit country by last year's tsunami. On Monday, hundreds gathered in Aceh to mark the anniversary of the tsunami. At 8:16 a.m., sirens from the region's new early warning system were sounded to mark the exact time the tsunami hit the coast. A minute of silence was then observed. Hundreds of white-clad Achenese held a morning memorial at the Grand Mosque, which was one of the area's only structures to remain standing after the tsunami. The death toll in Aceh is staggering, estimated between 150,000 and 200,000 people in the region alone. We are now going to hear from the GAM leader. Following the tsunami, humanitarian officials and human rights groups said the Indonesian military actively prevented aid from being distributed to Aceh. For years, the Indonesian military had operated in Aceh in an attempt to quell an independence movement led by the Free Aceh Movement, or GAM. The military reportedly killed thousands of people in Aceh. Exact figures have never been known because Indonesia closed Aceh off from outside observers and put it under martial law. Following the tsunami, both sides enter talks to discuss how to end the three-decade-old independence uprising. On Tuesday, leaders of the GAM officially announced the disarmament of their military wing. This is Irwanda Yusuf of the Free Aceh Movement.
On behalf of GAM combatants, I have the honor to announce that the Aceh National Armed Force, TNA, or gun fighters are now demobilized and decommissioned. We have now handed over all our arms in compliance to the agreement of the Memorandum of Understanding signed between the government of Indonesia and the Free Aceh Movement in Helsinki on August 15, 2005.
That was Irwanda Yusuf of the Free Aceh Movement. The agreement, however, has been criticized by some because it'll leave close to 25,000 Indonesian soldiers and police in Aceh. Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono has said he's optimistic about the outcome of the agreement.
I am urging all Acehese to make the peace process a success. Let us maintain the end of this conflict. Let us nurture, let us make strong and everlasting our sense of brotherhood.
Indonesian President Yudhoyono. We turn now to an excerpt from an interview we did a year ago, just after the tsunami hit, with journalist and activist Alan Nairn. Alan had just recently returned from Aceh, spent a good deal of time in the devastated region of Aceh. This is what he had to say about the tsunami and the political situation that was affecting the relief efforts in the area.
The military, until about 24 hours ago, was impeding international aid agencies from coming in. There was a medical team from Japan that flew in and turned around in frustration because the military wasn't letting them enter. This has undoubtedly caused thousands of extra deaths. The reason the military won't let them in is that Aceh has been under semi-totalitarian de facto occupation by the Indonesian military. On TV, people may have seen footage of the Grand Mosque of Banda Aceh, one of the few big structures left standing. And in the yard in front of the mosque, it's littered with bloated bodies and dead animals and debris, and the building itself is cracked. It's now a scene of devastation. But just 5 years ago, the yard in front of that mosque was filled with anywhere from 400,000 to a million Acehese who were carrying out a peaceful demonstration calling for a referendum. A vote, a free vote, in which they could choose whether they wanted to become independent of Indonesia. In proportional terms, Aceh has a population, or before this disaster, had a population of about 4 million. This means that anywhere from 10% to 25% of the entire population of Aceh turned up on the lawn of the mosque that day to call for freedom. It's actually one of the largest political demonstrations in recent world history. If a similar thing happened in the U.S., you'd be talking anywhere from 30 to 60 million people here, to give an idea of the enormity. Faced with that kind of civilian movement, the Indonesian military moved to crush them, assassinating disappearing leaders, raping female activists.
That was Alan Nairn speaking a year ago about the situation in Aceh. We're joined now in our D.C. studio by Ed McWilliams. He is a former State Department official who headed the political section of the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta from 96 to 99. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Can you talk about the situation today in Indonesia and back then, a year ago, this anniversary of the tsunami, and the political developments with the GAM disbanding?
Right. Well, if I could just sort of broadly, sort of a broad brush picture of what's going on in Indonesia right now. President Yudhoyono, who took power in a democratic election in October of 2004, has a few major challenges and then some very specific challenges facing him. He needs to, of course, work on the economy. He needs to get the military under control. No president since Suharto, the dictator, has been able to do that. He must deal with tremendous brutality by the military in the province of West Papua. And then he must also deal with human rights problems, particularly the murder of the most prominent human rights activist by poisoning on an international flight. But then, of course, his other major problem is dealing with the situation in Aceh. But these other problems relate to that. In particular, I would like to talk a little bit with you about the situation with regards to the military and its role in Aceh now, and its prospective role in Aceh.
Yes, if you would do that. The situation now is people are talking about there's a peace accord.
Right. There has been a peace accord that was, as was mentioned earlier in your program, signed back in August. And this is really a very hopeful development. It's one of the really few hopeful developments to come out of the tsunami. Thanks to international pressure and some effective work by ministers within Yudhoyono's government, the military was essentially forced into accepting an agreement whereby they would accept a ceasefire and then finally a peace agreement with the resistance force that had been operating there for almost 30 years. What's happened over the last months since this signature back in August of that agreement is that the resistance, the armed resistance, has essentially met its obligation. As you heard earlier in your program, they have disarmed, which is a very critical step, the first time they've taken that step. Moreover, they've abandoned officially their drive for independence. However, the Indonesian military, for its part, was to withdraw half of its forces, approximately 24,000 troops, from Aceh in order for peace to move forward. The difficulty is, just in the last few days, it has become apparent that the military is trying to move back into Aceh with a strength of 15,000 troops, allegedly to perform rehabilitation and reconstruction work. This is a would seem to be an obvious breach of the agreement and could threaten that agreement. I would add one other thing that's important. It was not mentioned by the GOM official, but as it stands now, GOM is supposed to be taking part, not as GOM, but as independent Achenese civilians, taking part in the elections in April. But government officials in Jakarta are saying that they may not be able to pass laws in sufficient time to make that possible, which is, again, a breach of the agreement. The Aceh rebels have disbanded and disarmed with the expectation that they would participate in these elections in April. They may not take place, according to government officials, just making announcements the last couple of days.
We're talking to Ed McWilliams. He is a former State Department official, headed the political section of the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta from 96 to 99, well known as he left the embassy for his fierce criticism, both of the Indonesian regime and also of the U.S. government, particularly when it came to the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. Can you talk about, you mentioned Munir, one of the leading human rights activists of Indonesia, poisoned on his way out of the country, and the significance of the trial that took place and whether it means anything.
Yes, well, it was a very tragic event. Munir was a young man in his late 30s and was by far the most prominent human rights activist and critic of the military, I might add. Through my years when I was there in the late 90s and then up until his murder. What happened was that he was taking a flight to the Netherlands and was given poisoned arsenic and died en route to the Netherlands. Initially, it was said it was just a normal death, but investigators in the Netherlands discovered that, in fact, he had ingested arsenic. There was a trial, and it just concluded this past week, in which one individual, an official of the airlines, was accused and convicted of having slipped him the poison. The problem is that one official had extensive contact, telephone contact, just before and just after the murder with the intelligence officials called BIN. These are ex-military officials who had been in frequent confrontation with Munir. Unfortunately, despite the assurances of President Yudhoyono that there would be justice in this case because it was such a prominent case, the court apparently has stopped with just the conviction of this one scapegoat Garuda Airlines official. And the concern is that the people who actually planned it and directed it, most likely being members of BIN, the military intelligence, the now civilian intelligence agency, were responsible. It appears that they will not be pursuing those people for conviction.
You now work on West Papua. And as we wrap up the year, from the tsunami a year ago to the political developments in Aceh to West Papua, what do you expect?
Well, it looks very bad right now because although the military does appear to be moving some of its troops back into Aceh in violation of that agreement, as I mentioned, other troops appear to be coming out of Aceh and going into West Papua, where there's a minuscule armed resistance, approximately 500 or 600 people. But there in West Papua, there are great riches, as there are in Aceh, that the military hopes to tap into. And our concern is that, in fact, we will see increased brutality as the number of military in West Papua rise. One thing that I should mention, both in the context of Aceh and West Papua, is that the military relies on non-government sources, resources, for 70% of its budget. That's one of the reasons it's remained a rogue institution for all of these years. The civilian government is pledged to try to gain control of it by forcing it to essentially take only government money and not to operate illegal operations, civilian trafficking, population trafficking, I should say, people trafficking, and drug running, and so on. The danger is now that the military will be seeking to get non-governmental funds from illegal operations in West Papua, and perhaps also draw money, including international funding, from engagement in rehabilitation and reconstruction work in Aceh.
Ed McWilliams, if you look at the amount of aid that poured into the region and to Indonesia after the tsunami, and yet you look today at the reports of the number of people who are still homeless, who are living in tents, almost everyone in some kind of a temporary shelter in Aceh right now. Some have said if you took that money and you gave it to the suffering people, particularly of Aceh, you would bring them all into the middle class. But that's not any way that the aid works and was distributed. Where did it go?
Well, in one sense, it hasn't gone anywhere because it's been dispersed very, very slowly. Of the approximately 500,000 people made homeless, only 24,000 homes in the provinces of Aceh and Nias, which were most affected, have actually been built. A lot of the money simply hasn't been spent. I think our concern is not so much at this point that there's been waste, but there's been a dragging of feet, that things haven't been accomplished that might have been accomplished. Unfortunately, though, this real fact is one of the excuses being used by the military and the Aceh-Nias Reconstruction and Rehabilitation Agency. This is the excuse that's being used by them to try to make a basis for bringing in the military to work on reconstruction and rehabilitation to speed it up. In point of fact, we need to see more in concerted action by international agencies, but also civilian agencies of the government.
And this last 10 seconds we have, the U.S. lifting, giving a waiver to the Indonesian military, restoring military aid that had been cut off with the Indonesian military rampaging through Timor.
Yeah, that's really a critical point that needs to be made. The U.S. essentially has forfeited much of its leverage over the Indonesian military and over the Indonesian government to essentially address these critical problems of possible breaking of the agreement in Aceh, human rights abuse in West Papua, justice for Munir. The U.S. now is not in a position to use the offer of military assistance to the military as leverage, because that offer now has been essentially already made. It's already flowing.
Former State Department official Ed McWilliams joining us from Washington. That does it for today's broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Abdul Kadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Nell Geiser, Uri Galed. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.